Hi, this is Peter Asher, and you're listening to the Rock Solid Podcast.
Make me a deal and make it good for me. I won't get full of myself, I can't afford to be. This is small town music, this is big town music. He's ahead of his time, you know, but he can't use it. If only he could prove it. Well, tomorrow's just a song away, a song away.
Hey everybody, welcome to Rock Solid, the comedy podcast for all things music, both new and classic. I'm Pat Francis, and joining me in the Zoom room is a man who has been working in the music business for over 50 years. He wears many hats as a writer, performer, producer, and now author. Please welcome Mr. Peter Asher. Peter, good morning.
Good morning.
So we're both on the West Coast.
Yes, I'm in Malibu on the beach.
And
there are worse places to be locked down.
There are worse places to be locked down, although the air quality for us right now is not great.
Correct.
Who are you quarantining with? Who's there? Are you home alone?
No, just my wife and I, and our daughters here some of the time.
And how long have you been in the States?
Oh, I moved here in 1970.
So you're a citizen. Do you have dual citizenship?
I do.
All right, so you can vote.
Yes.
Excellent.
I shall.
Yes, so shall I. All right, Peter. So you have a new book out. Well, it came out in 2019. You actually had lots of projects in 2019. You curated the James Taylor box set. I think you oversaw the remastering. You also were the executive producer of the Linda Ronstadt Live in Hollywood LP.
Yes.
And then the book.
Yeah, and the book grew out of my radio show, of course. The book didn't spring from nothing. I have a radio show on Sirius XM once a week about the Beatles, which Apple and the Beatles asked me to do, and I was happy to do, and I still do that, and it's fun. And I did a series of those shows based around the alphabet, not using the alphabet in any encyclopedic way, but simply the same way Sesame Street does, as a kind of clue, you know, follow the letter wherever it takes you. Song titles, people, places, things, whatever. And a publisher came to me and said, we think those episodes, the alphabet episodes, would make a good book. So I said, okay. Because I've turned down all the offers to do an autobiography, at least so far. But then this seemed like, well, this is a different kind of project, and it made sense to me. So I said, yes.
And this is kind of cool because we do get a sense of you as a person and things that you've gone through in your life without it being, like you said, a straight up autobiography.
Yes, correct.
And are you against doing an autobiography?
At the moment, I think not. But, you know, everyone's done one. I mean, everyone, especially in Beatle world, everyone who works for the Beatles ever, the doorman, at Apple have all written books. I think, you know, the only people in the building who hadn't written a book in the Beatles and myself. So I, for the moment, I thought I'd keep it that way, but you never know.
And you are, you're very, very close to the Beatles because Paul McCartney dated your sister Jane. And he actually, according to the book, he lived at your house.
Yes, he did. Yeah, for a couple of years. But I mean, I never want to exaggerate that closeness. Yes, I mean, I got to know Paul pretty well mm-hmm. during that time. I worked at Apple, obviously, as head of A&R
right.
for a while. But there's too many people kind of going, I was the fifth Beatle, and I said to John, and George told me,
well,
and all that. So, but yes, I got to know them, and I obviously was a big fan, and I liked them. And Paul and I particularly obviously spent a lot of time together.
Yeah, well, I would never overstate your place in the Beatles history.
Well, everyone does, you know. So I mean, not that there are, you know. So I'm always anxious to make no assumptions.
You know? No, that's good. No, I like that about you because you have done so many things in your career. You don't have to stand on the shoulders of the Beatles. You've produced literally any Linda Ronstadt song that anyone knows. If I say name your top five Linda Ronstadt songs and people name those, you produce those. Without
almost.
A doubt.
Almost. Except for Long, Long Time and the Stone Ponies.
Right.
Which were on some people's list correctly. But yes, beyond that, generally speaking, yes, what you say is true. Certainly from Heart Like a Wheel onwards, all those pop hits, you know, starting with You Are No Good and all of that.
Feeling better now that we're through.
Yes.
and then the Mariachi Ranchera records and the Nelson Riddle records. Yes, I did all those.
Before we jump in the book, since I brought up Linda Ronstadt, I want to ask you, what was it like in the studio with Linda Ronstadt? Because you have this perfect voice.
Yes.
What is your job? Are you bringing the songs in? Because Linda wasn't a songwriter. She would record songs that other people wrote. Was that one of your jobs? I mean, I would...
We chose songs between us. I would say Linda chose the majority of them. I mean, she certainly had an absolute right to sing what she wanted to. I mean, she the way she sees it, she'll hear a song and feel compelled to sing it. She'll hear a song and go, I must sing that song.
Gotcha.
And she takes a song and makes it, the way she sings it, makes it sound as if she'd written it. You know, makes it sound as if it was her song and her life. And that's one of her, you know, extraordinary abilities on top of her amazing voice. But yes, I would suggest songs. And certainly what we collaborated on without doubt is the arrangement and production and so on. And what kind of instrumentation and who played on it. And all that stuff was stuff that Linda and I worked on jointly.
And who in the studio, when she does a vocal track... Who decides if it's the right one or not? I mean, I would assume that every time she sang was pretty much perfect.
That's pretty much true, though she wouldn't agree with you. She's a perfectionist that has very high standards. Yeah, there would be occasions when she would do a vocal I thought was the one and she'd want to do a few more. But sometimes I was right and we came back to the one I liked in the first place. So it was a joint effort.
Okay, excellent.
You know, I provided another ear and somebody else to bounce ideas off and so on. So I would say that it was all a collaboration.
And is that the main job of the producer? Because, you know, we always read the producer credit on the back of our favorite albums, but we never really know exactly what you're doing. Like, I don't know, you know.
Nobody does, and neither do producers know what each other do. I mean, don't forget, we don't get to watch each other work.
That's true.
It's a mystery to us, too. When we hear a great record, we go, what did he do? But, or she do. But it varies enormously. I mean, in some cases, like Linda was there every second of every record we made. Then other records I'd make, like working with Cher or somebody who I admire enormously and is amazing, but she would just come in and sing, you know, and leave.
Beneath the white fire of the moon, love's wings are broken all too soon. We never loved her together alone. Don't you sometimes wish your heart was a hard stone?
Didn't mean she didn't have clear ideas of what the record should be like. She did. But she'd be off dealing with a, you know, movie script or the new perfume bottle or whatever it was. And I'd be making the record and then she'd come in and sing really well. But some people are much more involved in the nuts and bolts of it than others.
Right. That's for Cher. She had other things going on, you know, acting or, like you said, a clothing line or perfume. And Linda was always all about the music.
Yes, exactly. You know, even in terms of stage shows and everything. I mean, she didn't dance. She didn't, you know, do anything, and she walked on the stage and sang brilliantly, amazingly well, and then said goodnight, thank you. You know,
right.
If she did talk to the audience, she'd often get in trouble because she'd be in Vegas and advising people not to drink and gamble and things like that.
Trying to keep people in the straight and narrow in Vegas isn't the best thing.
That happened, and then management was not keen.
All right, we'll talk about some other stuff too, but I want to get to the book for sure. I love this book because it's one of these books, of course, you should read it front to back, but you can drop in anywhere on this book, you know?
Oh, yeah, it's not a coherent story. It's a series of odds and ends filed under the letters of the alphabet.
And you have it in the back, the index is meticulous. Like you have the songs in alphabetical order and you have the songs, you know, you can find any song you want to talk about.
Well, yeah, I mean, I wanted to, I hate books without an index anyway. So
yeah, I do too.
I made sure there was a proper index. And yes, then in addition to that, we created a sort of playlist, you know, as it were, of all the songs that I talked about.
And the songs in this book, it's not just Beatles recorded songs. It could be solo songs. It could be, you know, Traveling Wilburys. It could be many, many, anything Beatles related that the Beatles individually played on might be in this book too.
Oh, indeed. And or anything the Beatles talked about or liked. Or, I mean, it's there's Chuck Berry stuff and there's all, you know, it's Beatle related, same yes. as what I play on the radio. But it's not all Beatles songs necessarily, no. And so, the stories that are unrelated to, I throw in a lot of extraneous information. I mean, you know, people kept wondering what I was going to do when I got to Zed, you know, because there are, I think, two Zed Beatles songs, Zigzag and something else, I can't remember. But in fact, you know, I talked about all kinds of stuff, particularly, of course, the zebra crossing, famous zebra crossing in right. Abbey Road. Once I'm talking about that, like you can walk across it and be in the studio and you can talk about every song the Beatles ever recorded. So, but I also talked about the man who invented zebra crossings, Lord Hoare Bill Isher, and interesting stuff like that, at least stuff I find interesting. But it's all a bit peripatetic and selective.
The canvas was blank and wide, and you could do whatever you wanted with it.
Yes.
You didn't go to a publisher. A publisher came to you. That's got to be fun.
Yes, it was nice because I assumed it was another autobiography effort. And I kept saying no to lunch. And but then they said, no, we have an idea. We want to talk to you about an idea. It's nothing to do with an autobiography. And I went, oh, okay.
And what's great, it's not really their idea. It's your idea. And they just took, like you said, the radio show and wanted it in book
form. There was a guy called Paul Gollop at Henry Holt, which is an old and respectable publisher, part of Macmillan now. And he was a fan of the radio show. And it was his idea that series of shows should be a book.
Let me jump to, this is, I guess, over 50 years ago now. When Peter and Gordon, and of course that's Gordon Waller, you guys recorded yep. and had a number one single in the UK and in the US with A World Without Love, which yep. is credited to Lennon and McCartney, but it started as a Paul song.
It was entirely a Paul song, but they shared credit on everything, even if only one of them wrote it at that time.
Gotcha. And what was it like? You're 20 years old and you have a number one single. I mean, were you prepared for that?
It was excellent. no, you don't need to. You mean, you know, no preparation necessary. You know, let look at it this way. What, you know, at one point, one moment I was a philosophy student at London University. And I'd be, you know, bicycling home from school to home in on a winter's afternoon, you know, in England in the winter. It's dark by about 4:30. It's cold. It's raining. And you're bicycling home. A year later, I was driving down Sunset Boulevard in a rented Mustang convertible being recognized by beautiful women. And that was a substantial improvement. No preparation was necessary. I just went for it.
And you're still here, and you still do shows, and you seem vital and as active as ever.
Yeah, I'm delighted to be on the not dead yet list. You know? or with people my age, you know, if people of any degree of celebrity, very minor celebrity, your first question always is, well, are they still alive? And I'm certainly happy that in my case, the answer as of right now is yes.
But you're also not retired. A lot of people at your age.
No, I'm not. No, I have no desire to retire. I'm not. I wouldn't know how to play golf if you begged me.
I think a lot of times when you decide to retire, that kind of ends the life. As long as you keep going, you know.
Some people say that, and then of course some people may have an incredibly productive retirement, but that usually means they haven't really quite retired.
Right. Exactly.
But no, I like working, and I feel privileged, obviously, at my age that I can occasionally get work producing a record or working on a movie song or whatever it is. I'm luckily still have, you know, friends and connections in the business and still get work, which is easier said than done sometimes.
True.
Yeah. Regardless of one's past achievements, it goes to that thing of, you know, get me the new so-and-so, you know what I mean? Get me the modern equivalent of.
Who's the new Peter Asher?
But I'm still here.
You're still here. They can still get you if they have your phone number.
They can.
To list your producing credits, that would take the whole hour. But, you know, James Taylor, Neil Diamond, 10,000 Maniacs, just so many. And a lot of times, like, for example, with 10,000 Maniacs, their most popular albums have your name on them. For whatever reason, the stars aligned or whatever, or it's a credit to you.
I think probably a bit of both. I mean, I'm not denying myself any credits.
No,
certainly.
Don't.
I think Blind Man Zoo and In My Tribe are terrific albums. Because before that, they'd made a couple of indie albums that I thought didn't present the band or the songs as well as they could be presented. So, you know, I had a number of meetings with the band. I'm with Natalie, and we decided to go for it. So, yes, I'm very proud of those records. So I'll take some of the credit for sure. But, that's one of the very few bands I've worked with. It's interesting. I've ended up mostly working with solo singers and actually mostly women for some reason.
Well, the first time that I ever saw Peter Asher's name, I was 13 years old, and I hear this James Taylor song on the radio, Your Smiling Face.
Smiling face, I have to smile myself because I love you. Yes, I do. And when you give me that pretty little pout, it turns me inside out. There's something about you, baby. I don't know. Isn't it amazing a man like me can feel this way? Tell me how much longer it will grow stronger every day.
So I run down to the record store, buy the 45. I see your name on it for the first time. And then when the album comes out, I buy JT. It's still my favorite James Taylor album. I don't know if it's because that was my introduction to his music.
That's so interesting. Yeah, because of course that was quite late on in that we did, you know, in the different phases. There was the Apple album, then there were all the Warner Brothers albums, most of which I did, a couple of which couple of great ones were done by Russ Titelman and Lenny Waronker. Mm-hmm. And then James and I got back together for me to produce JT, the first album on CBS Records.
The song Your Smiling Face, it is so perfect to me. It's got that opening guitar riff. It's got an amazing Leland Sklar bass line. And there's even like kind of a bass solo in there.
No one can tell me that I'm doing wrong today. Whenever I see you smile at me. No one can tell me that I'm doing wrong today. Whenever I see your smiling face my way. No one can tell me that I'm doing wrong today.
The production on that whole album is, I just love it top to bottom, every single song. And then you stuck around. You were there then for Flag, which I think is the first time I ever saw a picture of you inside the cover.
Oh,
and I was like, who's this cool looking ginger? Because you got the long red hair in there.
Yes.
And and then Dad Loves His Work. And I'm a fan of James Taylor. And of course, I love all the albums you've produced with him.
Needless to say, me too. I think he's still, the very first time I heard him, I kind of, as it were, discovered him in the showbiz vernacular. And I was blown away the minute I heard him sing and play.
His playing and singing always seems so effortless to me.
Yeah, they do seem effortless. Of course, they're not. Infinite amounts of practice and work went into that, and that's why he manages to combine, the elegance of a classical guitar player and his finger picking, along with the sort of a folky consciousness but jazzy chords, and his singing is much more influenced by Ray Charles and Sam Cooke than it is by Woody Guthrie, So it's an extraordinary mixture of great American traditions, musically speaking.
So when you were made the head of A&R at Apple Records.
Yes.
And how old are you at that point? 24, maybe?
I suppose so, yes. Something like that.
Now,
maybe a little younger. I don't know. Well, let's see. I guess I made the James Taylor album in 68. So, yes. I was born in 44. So, yes, that would have been about right.
So when you get that job, you've never had a position like that before.
No.
So how are you prepared to do that? Obviously, you've been around the music business.
Once I figured out what Head of A&R was supposed to do, and Paul and I had a lot of discussions about Apple and about the label and what it was intended to be and intended to accomplish, then I just sort of jumped in. I mean, I think we have inbuilt youthful confidence for a reason, because if you didn't, you'd never do anything when you were young. I've never done that before. How do I do it? I would never. But when I took on James's management, it was, it wasn't because I thought I knew how to do it. It was because I thought I could figure out how to do it, and how hard can it be? I learned on the job, of course, which means you make mistakes. But so did Brian Epstein with the Beatles. The point is, the one ingredient Brian and I had in common, and we neither of us managed anyone before, obviously, when we started, each of us, and. Was how brilliant our clients were. I mean, people often ask me, what's the secret of being a great manager? And it's pathetically obvious. It's having a great client. It's just, I got to induct the first two managers ever invited to join the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And not surprisingly in the least, they were Brian Epstein and Andrew Lou Goldham.
Yeah.
The Beatles and the Rolling Stones. It's like, duh, So that's how you get to be a great manager. Find the Beatles. Find James Taylor. I told you it was easy.
The original James Taylor album that was on Apple Records. This was the first artist that was brought to Apple that one of the Beatles didn't find. Is that correct?
Well, he's the first artist that was brought to Apple. I mean, he was
the first one
signing.
Flat out. Okay, cool.
He was the first signing to Apple Records.
And what I've got, baby, don't show. Now I won't try to teach you how. Don't talk now,
Don't talk sand. Don't talk dust. Don't talk no man. Don't talk rules. Don't talk clouds. Don't talk now.
Yes, he did not come through a Beatle. He came through me.
Because at the time...
And there are other arts... There are other artists who didn't come through a Beatle as well. For example, the Ivies, who became Badfinger,
right,
were brought in by Mal Evans, the Beatles' roadie. So, you know, and then some, of course, did come directly from the Beatles. And then, like, Mary Hopkin, who was one of Apple's biggest hits.
Once upon a time, there was a tavern where we used to raise a glass or two. Remember how we
came in a kind of roundabout way, actually. They came indirectly through Twiggy, supermodel Twiggy, back when there was only one supermodel. And it was her. And she was the one who happened to be watching television when Mary was on a television talent show called Opportunity Knocks. And she called Paul, their great friends, and said, "You have to watch this girl. She's singing a Joan Baez song right now." There But for Fortune, I think it was. And Paul watched, and I watched, and we signed her.
Yeah, you couldn't go to YouTube back then. You had to turn on the television immediately and check it out, or you'd miss it.
I have a feeling that I did miss it the first time. By the time Paul called me, I think I couldn't get the TV on quick enough. But luckily, she went through till the next week. So it was a sort of American Idol type of show. And she survived till the next week, so I got to watch her. And that's we all had a conversation, and we decided to sign her, and we did.
When you bring up these names, you know, Twiggy, Mary Hopkins, Badfinger, it's like this scene that I want to be transported back to and be...
Well, there were different scenes. There was Liverpool was going on. I guess that was sort of a scene. And people assume that was all... I mean, that was one of the weirdest things. When we came to America, you know, for the first time, post-Beatles, obviously, they came when I Want to Hold Your Hand was number one. We came when World Without Love was number one, which I guess was about 6 months later. And everyone was asking what Liverpool was like. And we had to explain we'd never been there. You know, and they went, "What do you mean? You know, Liverpool is this magic place that everyone comes from." We went, "No, it's a shithole ship. You know, it's a town on the coast of, you know, shipping port town." And everyone we knew from Liverpool, the minute they could afford a train ticket, they were in London. You know, so, but I think Liverpool was kind of a community, actually. All the bands did tend to know each other.
Right.
But, you know, Twiggy and I become friends, and Paul and Twiggy become friends. Yes, obviously. And eventually, I suppose the pop scene grew into kind of community as we'd all meet each other. But it didn't feel that way at the beginning. No, I mean, Paul was a friend of Twiggy's, and she called her friend to say, "Listen to this girl sing." It was more that than a community, really.
Gotcha. With this album, why wasn't there a... I mean, this was a critical success. Maybe
sort of.
Not.
Yeah, got some good reviews. Yeah.
But it didn't sell a lot of copies. But why wasn't there a second James Taylor album on Apple? Why wasn't Sweet Baby James on Apple Records?
Because Apple was falling apart at that time. You know, that was when the Beatles were arguing in the all these business issues. That was when Alan Klein came in. When Alan Klein came in, we knew that John and George and Ringo had won the argument with Paul, and that Alan was coming in as the boss. I knew about Alan Klein before from friends in New York, and who told me he was kind of a crook. And so we decided to leave. So we just left. Eventually, that's when I became his manager. And moved to America, bet my career on his in order to represent him. And the Apple could have sued us. I'm not honestly quite sure. The stories vary. It's whether they didn't sue us just because everything was in chaos,
right,
or they didn't sue us because the Beatles told Alan Klein not to sue us, which is a story I've also heard, and I've never really got to the bottom of it. Somebody said that George specifically said to Alan Klein, no, that's not what Apple is about. We don't sue people. Don't. And then shortly thereafter, the whole thing collapsed anyway. So even if they'd sued us, it might have gone nowhere. And Warner Brothers, to their credit, which the label probably wouldn't do now, did indemnify us against that happening, because I said when I made the deal with Warner Brothers, I said, look, you have to, if Alan Klein sues us, you have to deal with it. We have no money, we have no lawyers, you know, over to you. And they said okay.
Well, see, that's a very good that's a great idea on your part to take care of that right up front.
Yes, and I, as I say, labels now probably wouldn't do it because they're all, you know, owned by big corporations who don't risk lawsuits. But at the time, they definitely did.
And then you guys record Sweet Baby James, and I think that's still one of James Taylor's top one or two biggest selling albums of all time.
Just yesterday morning, they let me know you were gone. Suzanne, the plans they made put an end to you. I walked out this morning and I wrote down this song. I just can't remember who to send it to. I've seen fire and I've seen rain. I've seen sunny days that I thought would never end. Seen lonely times when I could not find a friend, but I always thought that I'd see you again. Won't you look down upon me?
Yes, I think the Greatest Hits album is the biggest selling, as
right,
is often the case. But of the actual albums, I think Sweet Baby James is right up there, and JT is probably close behind.
And again, there you go. Pat on the back to from me to Peter Asher for those great records.
Well, thank you.
For the Greatest Hits record, he actually re-records two songs that were on the original Apple album, Something in the Way She Moves and Caroline on My Mind.
In.
Oh, what did I say? On? Oh, I'm done.
It's so common.
It is common.
I automatically correct people, but it's totally annoying. But it's Caroline in My Mind, of course.
In my mind, I'm gone to Carolina. Can't you see the sunshine? Can't you just feel the moonshine? Ain't it just like a friend of mine to hit me from behind? Yes, I'm gone to Carolina in my mind. Karen, she's a silver sun, your best walker.
And yes, we re-recorded them because there was legal chaos surrounding everything to do with Apple, and there was no way to officially use those two tracks. So we redid them, and they're very different versions, because the Apple version was a very specific, arranged, had string quartet and all this stuff. And we did one more like what James was doing on the road at the time.
And whose idea was it for the musical, like, string interludes between the songs on the original James Taylor album?
Me.
Something in the way she moves, or looks my way, or calls my name, that seems to leave this troubled world behind. And if I'm feeling down and blue.
And what was it? What was the thought process?
I think the reason I got my friend Richard Houston did all those arrangements.
Okay.
And he was a is a classical composer and jazz trumpet player and guitarist, a brilliant musician. I played in the jazz group. I played very badly, played bass in the group with him for a while, and became an admirer of his musical ability and knowledge. And so when we were doing the album, I decided I wanted to put some arrangements on things. And that was motivated, I think, by a desire to make people pay attention to the record, to make, because I was really worried that, you know, there would be, it's another long-haired American folk singer thing. Because, and by the way, it's worth noting that the term singer-songwriter didn't exist. If you had long hair and played the acoustic guitar, you were a folk singer. It didn't matter if you never sang a damn folk song in your whole life.
Gotcha.
And James was a folk singer, don't get me wrong. He could sing you a great Woody Guthrie song and so on. But he was much more a songwriter. And eventually, of course, when James and Neil and Joni and everybody took over the world, suddenly they were all singer-songwriters. But that little name didn't exist.
Didn't exist. Wow.
Didn't exist. But anyway, where was I? So I wanted to separate James from what I saw as sort of the folky movement.
Gotcha.
And that's why I decided to put some arrangements on the songs and join them up musically, just to make people pay attention to the record. On balance, I think some of that was a bit of overproduction. Some of the songs were not necessarily well served by the arrangements. But I think conceptually, the idea sort of worked. People did go, oh, this is interesting and different. And listen to the way all these songs are joined up and so on. That's why I did it.
And the song, Something in the Way She Moves, that's a line that George Harrison used in
yes.
his song.
Yeah.
Did that just stick in his head and it's just a thing that happened?
Only George could really tell us the answer to that question. But yes, he obviously liked the line. He knew it was from James's song, and
sure.
he wrote obviously a completely different and unbelievably good song. So in the end, everyone came out a winner.
Attracts me like no other lover. Something in the way she woos me. I don't want to leave her now.
You know, James was honored.
I'm sure. 2010, you produced Carole King and James Taylor live at the Troubadour.
Yeah.
And my question
was that too good? It was 10 years ago already.
Amazing. I know. It's unbelievable. Yeah. I saw that tour at that show at the Hollywood Bowl. It was amazing. My question is about with the quarantine right now, what do you think is going to happen to some of these iconic venues like the Troubadour? Are they going to be able to survive this lockdown?
I mean, they're doing all they can. You know, they formed this organization, Neva, for all those small venues. If anything, it's probably going to be a little bit easier for someone like the Troubadour that has an actual national reputation.
Right.
I would imagine they'll find raising money a bit easier than some of the less well-known clubs, many of which I play now and love. You know, they're all over the country.
Yeah.
200-400 seat venues, which are the kind of places that I play on my own, and you know that's about my size. I can sell 400 or 500 tickets, and I will miss them enormously, and I hope they all survive. Certainly, I've done it, but every time I've been asked to do anything, make an appeal or appear in a streamed broadcast or something on behalf of those clubs, I absolutely say yes. And if it's any help. And I don't know. The answer is we won't know. We hope so. But, you know, I have a horrible feeling that, you know, the big places are going to survive, you know,
yeah.
somehow, because
right.
they're owned by AEG or Live Nation, who have a gazillion dollars. But we can only hope that it's, you know, that no one suddenly decides to turn the Troubadour or its equivalents, lesser known equivalents
right.
all over the country, that it's easier to turn them into a McDonald's than it is to keep them alive. I hope that doesn't happen.
Yeah, I mean, one of the smaller venues that I know you've played out here is McCabe's Guitar Shop.
Yes, though, of course, they may survive because people still buy guitars. I suppose they're open. My guess is, I assume you can still go to McCabe's and buy a guitar.
I think you can.
But I don't think you can go to a gig. So,
no.
But I'm hoping that at least they have a dual function and maybe they're okay.
Yeah, that's a good, I never thought of that. They are a, it's right in the name, guitar shop.
Yes.
Yeah, but with the Troubadour, there's so many, so many iconic people that have started there, you know, the Eagles.
Yeah, well, you see, it used to be, I mean, when James and I started, our ambition, our definition of success at that stage was selling out the folk clubs. If you could sell out the Bitter End in New York, Troubadour in L.A., Main Point in Philadelphia, Cellador in Washington, I can't remember all the others. Yeah. That was success. You'd play a week in each place, and often two shows a night.
Wow.
And if you sold out two shows a night for a week, man, you were a god.
Well, that is successful. Well, that's successful today if you sell out two shows a night for a week.
Exactly. But then, you know, a year later, we were selling out Madison Square Garden for a couple of nights. So yes, it went crazy.
So you're saying at that point, playing at the Hollywood Bowl or Madison Square Garden at that point wasn't even in your head. You just wanted the bottom line.
It was not on our agenda. And when it went from the clubs to theaters, you know, when you'd end up not playing the Troubadour, but playing the Santa Monica Civic Auditorium, which was the next stage up.
Right.
That already was a shock. And then when it turned out you could play Madison Square Garden or the Forum, that was extraordinary.
Well, that's great. That's the great thing about the trajectory of success in the music business. As the venues get bigger, you know that you're doing something right.
Yes. I mean, when you look at someone like Ed Sheeran, who I admire enormously and is a friend of mine, you know, that he went, you know, from playing, you know, busking, cinema queues, doing hundreds of shows and then playing little tiny clubs and anywhere he could. And suddenly he's, you know, selling out three nights at Wembley Stadium, which is, you know, almost 300,000 people with just him and his guitar, by the way.
Yeah.
You kind of go, my God, it can still happen, and it does, and it's exciting.
Yeah, I saw him open for Taylor Swift at the Staples Center, and I'm like, who's this guy? And then, you know, a year and a half later, oh, that's who he is. So
yeah,
it's amazing.
No, I didn't discover him in any sense, but I heard him in England when he was having his first British hit, and actually got in touch with him, and we worked together on an Elton John project because I told him, you know, I think I know a good singer-songwriter when I hear one, and you're it.
Goodbye, Norma Jean. Though I never knew you at all, you had the grace to hold yourself while those around you crawled. They crawled out of the woodwork and they whispered into your brain. They set you on the treadmill and they made you change your name. And it seems to me you lived your life like a candle in the wind, never knowing who to cling to when the rain set in. And I would like to have known you, but I was just a kid. The candle burned out long before your legend ever did.
And there's so many great singer-songwriters around now. It's crazy.
All right.
I mean, that's what Billie Eilish is. You know, she's a pop star, but she's a singer-songwriter. I saw her at the Troubadour, oddly enough. She did a little gig at the Troubadour. And she's so great, brilliant writer, brilliant singer, and that genius brother, Phineas. So, you know, and there's so many other people, both Brandys, Brandy Carlisle and Brandy Clark, I love as songwriters and as people and singers. And, you know, I get as excited now as I ever did about great singer-songwriters.
And with Phineas, I always tell people to seek out his music because I don't want him to get lost in the shuffle of his sister. But his solo music is terrific.
Yes, I've heard some of it, and yes, it is.
You need to pick me up. I'll be there in 25. I like to push my luck. So take my hand, let's take a drive. I've been living in the future, hoping I might see you sooner. I want you riding shotgun, I knew when I got one right. Let's fall in love for the night and forget in the morning.
Play me a song that you like. You can bet I'll know every line. I'm the boy that your boy hoped that you would avoid. Don't waste your eyes on jealous guys.
I have a 15-year-old daughter, so you can imagine that the Billie Eilish is playing in the house 24/7.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, I was having dinner with Hans Zimmer the other night, and you know, Hans told me how great it was working with her. You know, they did the Brits together doing the Bond song, because he scored the movie and she wrote the song. So, needless to say, Hans and Phineas, you know, fitted together right away as fellow keyboard nerds, and he was raving about how great Billie Eilish was as a person and as a singer in real life. I've never met her.
Yeah, I hope the Bond song gets re-released when the movie finally comes out, because they kind of lost traction on it because
of course, the
movie was announced and the song is out and then the movie's gone and so is the song. So, and it's a great song. So
that I've fallen for a lie. You were never on my side. Fool me once, fool me twice. Are you dead or bad?
If the movie's good, I think the whole thing will bounce back huge. Yeah, and I'm sure it is. Hans says it is, and he's honest about movies. He's
all right. Well, that's good. That's good to hear. That's a rock solid exclusive on the James Bond movie. All right. I chose some letters out of your book, and if I give you, you know, one of the songs from one of the letters, can you tell us a little bit?
If I can remember it, go ahead.
We'll start with A, and I think it's the first song you talk about in the book, All My Loving.
Paul wrote that, I guess, at our house, as I remember. I mean, I think the thing I talked about, maybe, I don't know, I obviously each song comes up on the radio often, so I say different things. I think one of the missed brilliant things in that record, it's a Paul song, obviously, but I'm particularly keen on John's guitar part, you know, because he plays this rhythm part in triplets all the way through. So it's close your da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, which is really hard to play.
Close your eyes and I'll kiss you. Tomorrow I miss you. Remember, I'll always be true. Pretend that I'm missing the lips I am missing, and hope that my dreams will come true. And then while I'm away, I'll write home every day, and I'll send all my loving to you. All my loving.
If you try playing that, you know, a good rhythm guitar player is not always easy to find. And because, you know, I love playing rhythm guitar myself. And John just powers that track through. It's between Ringo and his great squishy hi-hat sound and John's rhythm guitar that make that track rock. And in addition, of course, Paul has that walking bass part that goes with it. And it's an amazing song. You know, it's a wonderful song.
The talent that these four guys have at such a young age, it's kind of astounding. It's miraculous. I mean, how do they know how to write these lyrics? Where do these lyrics come from? You haven't lived a lot of life, you know, at 18 or 20.
No, but they start off writing pretty straightforward
love
songs.
Sure,
But clever ones. You know?
Yes.
You know, they wrote songs in the third person, not about themselves, about, you know, other people and stuff quite early on, where most people always start writing about, I'm so miserable because I love you and you don't return my phone calls or whatever it is. And, you know, there's a hit for you. I think their songwriting grew as they did. But how can you account for their prodigious talent and the fact that these four prodigiously talented people, each of whom could easily have been a star in their own right, one way or another, and became stars in their own right, you know, should end up joining together. So any band that can look upon George Harrison as like the other songwriter in the band is, you know, based on his catalog, is just nuts, you know. So, or that Ringo is the other personality in the band, when in most bands he would out-personality everyone in it, because with his charm and humor and cleverness and everything, quite apart from his brilliant drumming. So, it, you know, how and why that happened is a literally God only knows, if you believe that kind of thing. I don't think anybody knows, myself.
No. It's just, it is, it's like a miracle. The letter C, we talk about a John Lennon solo song, which was actually I think it was a single only. I don't think it was ever on an album. We're talking about Cold Turkey.
My feet are so heavy. So is my head. I wish I was a baby. I wish you was dead. Cold Turkey has got me.
Yeah, I think it was a hit. I don't know. As I say, when I write the shows and write the book, I'm looking stuff up and keeping my notes in front of me. So I don't remember a lot of stuff about it, but I think it was a single. It's a grim topic, you know? And John, there's quite a lot of quotes one can find, and I did find in researching it in all the various books, you know, including the reliable ones like Mark Lewisohn and Barry Miles and the books one can trust. John talked quite a lot about drugs, and because people always ask about drugs a lot because they think they're interesting. And the point James Taylor is always trying to make when people ask him about drug addiction is how boring it is. You know, that they picked a really boring topic because junkies are boring. I mean, because so much of their brain and lives are taken up by, you know, where am I going to score today? How am I going to get the money to score today? You know, you know, why can't I find the guy I'm trying to score off? You know, it's a continual quest, and it's a daily quest. So that does make drug addiction of all kinds fairly boring because it takes over your life. And most people you'll find who've come out of it, they neither do they warn boringly about it. They don't go, oh, kids, stay away from drugs. They just kind of go, you know, I don't recommend it. It was a mistake and it's really boring. And I think that's kind of what you can do. And if you're lucky enough to go through that and then survive, you know, you just kind of go, well done, and cross it off your list of things to never try. I never tried heroin in my life because I figure either it's going to be fantastically great, in which case you become a junkie.
Right.
Yes. Or it's not, and you start throwing up, which is no fun either. So, you know, I wasn't quite sure what the point of trying it would be, you know.
Yeah. I was down at James Taylor YouTube hole the other day, and there was an interview with him, and I'm paraphrasing, but he said he lost a lot of years to drugs. And that's a regret.
Yes, there's things he can't remember at all. Yeah. There's things I pointed out things to him that he'd said in an interview about the making of the Apple album or something. I said, I don't think that was quite it. And he went, oh, but then you're right, you know, because I don't hardly remember. You know, so I need any correction I had as a tentative suggestion. Maybe it was actually this way. And he went, okay, fine.
Well, the artists need you to keep the history going, Peter.
Well, except that my memory is not very good either. I rely a lot on looking stuff up. And luckily, it is funny how there are things that nobody knows, you know, just don't remember. And there's even, because people always think, if only I could ask the Beatles themselves, I'd have an answer. And that's not true, because their memories are unreliable too. And indeed, when you occasionally read an account of something that John gave and that Paul gave, they'll be completely different. Yeah. And nobody's cheating. They're just we all are old men with tired brains, you know.
And they live so much. The four of them live so much life as the Beatles in such a really short time period.
Yes, it was very fast.
So I mean, there's no possible way you could remember they probably couldn't remember things that happened 2 days before. I mean, because
exactly. And people would go, that happened in Paris. And someone goes, no, you couldn't possibly have done it happened in Paris because on that particular date you were in Cincinnati. And they, and generally the reply is, probably, you know, maybe.
People that listen to the show will send me an email and they'll say, oh, I loved when you asked Peter this question. And I won't even remember that I asked it to you. I'll have to go back and listen myself. So it's just stuff that happens in the moment that's not life-changing just doesn't stick in your brain unless you're
an
uber genius.
Yes, and the trouble is also that whole business with like false memories, and I don't mean, you know, weird, full implanted memories of child abuse or anything that complicated. But for example, I realized the other day, I was talking about Woodstock, and I was there, I was there. But I realized, thinking back, I couldn't separate acts I'd seen there when I was there and acts I saw in the movie.
Right.
So I couldn't remember. Now, is this image of Country on the Fish, was that the one in the movie or was that me standing on the side of the stage? I don't know. It's really weird, you know, but anyway.
That's why when people ask me what my favorite concerts were and, you know, my favorite band is Cheap Trick, and I saw them. It was like my second concert. And I know it's one of my favorite concerts, Peter, but I can't tell you any specifics about it. I just know that was a high point in my concert-going world.
Exactly. So, yeah.
Let's jump to letter H, even though the song begins with an A. You talk about that. It's a Hard Day's Night.
It's been a
I do know that this song has one of the most immediately recognizable opening chords.
It does.
Of all time.
And that's another one where people are going, we have to get to the answer, you know, because different people have given different accounts of the chord, you know.
Yeah.
And there isn't, no one's ever going to get, which is kind of nice, I think, to a definitive answer because, you know, it's been named various things, you know, the serious music people, you know, and the jazz people who know all these complicated chords, they even go, oh, it's a this and a ninth with the added 13th and blah, or whatever, and because they can hear it. But in the end, what it'll turn out to be is that a couple of different people played different chords, actually, which created this chord that you can give various names to. When they get really complicated, there's different ways to describe them. And the answer is no one exactly knows. And yes, it ended up being probably the most famous single chord introduction, maybe one of the most famous introductions of all.
Yeah.
But the Beatles are good at introductions. When you think about it, there's an awful lot of songs, that Beatles songs that you can identify in the first bar. You know, it's kind of amazing.
Yeah, and it's not always a guitar. Sometimes it's drums. It can be many different things. And you're just like, oh, I know that.
Yes, exactly. And they had a few songs which have a little bit, you know, they occasionally would use, like old-fashioned songs did, a little thing that precedes the actual song. You know, in the old days, most songs used to have what they called a verse back then.
Yeah.
It wasn't what we call a verse now at all. The verse was the little preface bit, you know? And like songs like If I Fell have one of those.
Yes.
You know?
If I fell in love with you, would you promise to be true and help me understand, 'cause I've been in love before and I found that love was more than just holding hands.
If I give my heart to you, I must be sure from the very start that you would love me more than.
If I fell in love with you, would you promise to be true and help me understand? Da 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 da. Just holding hands, and then the song starts.
Right.
If I fell, and that's a preface, you know, a verse. And a lot of old songs have those that people leave off.
Yeah.
You know, like White Christmas has one that you don't often hear.
The sun is shining, and the grass is green. The orange and palm trees sway. There's never been such a day in Beverly Hills, L.A. But it's December the 24th, and I'm longing to be up north.
It's something about, I'm sitting here in Beverly Hills, L.A. I remember that. It's something like, you know, as I sit here in Beverly, I can't remember the melody of it. Beverly Hills, L.A., that's why I'm dreaming of a white Christmas. But and
that's the part we don't hear. All. Yeah.
It's there. And the Beatles did that quite a few times, you know.
And even at their young age in their songwriting, you know, as they're developing it, they knew how to do that.
Yes, because Paul, in particular, you know, of course, knew a lot of the old songs that from his father and from listening to the radio or whatever, and so he totally got it about, you know, verse bridge verse, you know, chorus, where choruses fit in, including that thing about the prefatory verse that old songs used to have, right, which I kind of like.
The next one, letter L, and in the book you say this is a real favorite of yours. And my youngest daughter, her name is Rita. So what can you tell me about Lovely Rita?
I think in Lovely Rita in the book, I talk about parking meters quite a lot.
Because right, yes.
I talk about the arrival of parking meters in London. You know, the Paul got the idea, obviously, from the fact that parking meters had just been introduced. They were officially called parking wardens. The meter maid term was an American one that we had heard.
Yeah.
And Paul obviously liked. And he just, you know, everyone hated the parking wardens, of course. They were the enemy. I remember when they put parking meters outside our house in Wimpole Street. You know, and you woke up one day and you could no longer park outside your own house.
Terrible.
Like, my God, what is this appalling American invention that's been foisted upon us?
We still hate it.
Yeah, exactly. So I think Paul brilliantly, you know, and astonishingly had the idea of, well, what if you met a parking warden that you didn't hate? It was actually attractive and you actually took out for a cup of tea. I thought that was such an amazingly great idea.
Yeah, on paper, if someone said, "Hey, I have an idea for a song. It's based on these new parking meters," you'd say, "Well, you're crazy."
Maybe you would. Yeah, maybe you would. But I think you might go, well, you know, if you said, "I'm writing a song about hating traffic wardens,"
right,
as they call them, you know, you kind of go, oh. But I think if somebody's actually explained, look, how about a song that is actually a traffic warden that's really cute and that you don't hate, and they actually got, and I think you
that would sell it. That would definitely sell it.
I think so.
Letter M, we have a double M with Magical Mystery Tour.
So I kind of liked that movie, but I wasn't expecting it to be anything other than it was. You know, the BBC had commissioned the Beatles to do what they wanted, a zany but totally conventional Beatles movie. It was going to be shown on Boxing Day, I think, in England after Christmas.
Yes.
In the afternoon, and they wanted your parents and kids to enjoy the cute, zany Beatles, instead of which they got this weird avant-garde mishmash of stuff that was certainly odd and not what they expected and not what they wanted, and they didn't like it much. But, of course, they also got some amazingly good songs. And I remember going to the premiere of Magical Mystery Tour, which is a great event. It was what we call a fancy dress party, like a costume party. And everyone was dressed up as other things, and it was a great party, but terrible press for the movie itself. But of course, so many incredibly good songs, including Magical Mystery right. Tour itself.
So maybe you liked it, Peter, because you're an artist, so you got it, or you.
Well, I think it's also that I knew vaguely what they were up to. I right. wasn't on any of it myself, but I knew Paul had shown me the plans for the people and the bus and the all this. You know, there was going to be every day's adventures, and there was no really coherent storyline.
Right.
So it was clear to me this was going to be a pretty avant-garde mishmash, and I liked it because I was expecting that.
Yeah.
But they were expecting actual jokes and an actual comedy story, and they probably wanted a carry-on movie starring the Beatles, you know.
Yeah.
And they didn't get that.
They wanted Hard Day's Night 2 or...
Yeah, but
yeah, like in the U.S. we call it Middle America. It doesn't play in Middle America. I don't know what they call that in the U.K., but that just wasn't the thing.
Yes, exactly. And it's that particular because it's that day, you know, and television in on Christmas Day and Boxing Day is pretty traditional generally, you know.
Letter R. This is more of a deep track, but it's one that I've always loved too. Is Rain.
Yeah, I love that track. Ringo's drumming on that track, he himself has said, is different than drumming on almost everything else. There's some incredible drum fills in there. And Ringo explained to me exactly how he was starting with a different hand and with the different kinds of fills that wasn't used to doing. And if you listen to the drumming and the bass playing, there's that great moment in the middle where they kind of stop, and then Paul and Ringo do a fill exactly together, phrased precisely together. And I don't know if Ringo played it first and Paul invented a bass line to go with it, or how that came to be. It's a remarkable arrangement, that whole record.
It seems like drummers always cite Ringo as an influence.
Yes.
But yet sometimes people feel like Ringo is a simplistic drummer. What can you tell me?
He is sometimes, but when he is, it's usually the right thing to be, I think. I mean, sometimes simple drum parts are what works. Ringo plays the song. You know, if you think about it, there's so many songs where he doesn't immediately jump into a straight dung dung chuck, dung 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 chuck, you know, regular drum part. So his drum parts will be quite unusual, you know. Obviously, the obvious ones being like Come Together and things like that. Boom, boom, chung, ding, fiddly, biddly, biddly, boom, boom. You know, it's weird. Yeah.
Yes, it is.
It's not, you know, that you don't learn that in the drum books, and you don't hear that, because most drummers learn by playing along with records, and so you don't learn stuff like that. You learn, you know, either you go full out and learn to try and play like Buddy Rich, or you learn from all the American rock and roll records.
Right.
Ringo, I think, invented drum patterns, and so did Paul sometimes as well. He would contribute ideas in that regard, but one of the things that's most brilliant about Ringo is that his drumming is different on every song and fits every song. He played a shuffle with a certain kind of swing that no one else has ever quite mastered, in my view.
So you're saying Ringo plays what he feels benefits the song the most?
Yes, he doesn't immediately settle in for the groove, mm-hmm. you know. The groove comes, and those songs have a great groove, but sometimes the bass and drum parts are quite unusual.
You brought up Come Together. I had this on my initial notes. I wanted to ask you, I love the Aerosmith version of Come Together. I think that's a really great cover.
It's good, yeah.
How do you feel about people covering Beatles songs? It kind of feels a little bit sacrilegious in a way, because how are you going to best the best?
Well, you're not, probably. And so it's not sacrilegious. It's just difficult, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, difficult to you've got to think to yourself, why am I going to do this? You know, unless you can add something different to the song. I mean, I play quite a few cover versions on the radio show, but I try to play ones that I think have teach us something new about the song.
Something unique.
And not very easy to cover. And your ear is so close to the memory of the Beatle version, because the Beatle version is so imprinted in your brain that sometimes alternate versions just sound kind of wrong, you know. So it's difficult and dangerous, but fun, and can be really rewarding if you actually come up with something that's different. I don't think it's sacrilegious. I think anyone should have the right to sing anything, but and sing it however they want. It's like with Shakespeare, you know, people are always trying to do a new production.
Yeah.
Certainly they should, you know, and sometimes I'm sure those things, you know, allow you to see the play in a completely new light, and that's good. But so I don't think there should be any sense of that it's sacrilegious, but there should be a sense of this is a hard thing to do, and if you're going to do it, you might as well try something radical.
If I come to see a Peter Asher live show, do you play any Beatles songs in your set?
Not usually, no. I think I have done on one or two occasions, but no, generally not.
Letter T, Ticket to Ride. It's one of my favorites.
Yeah, those I love those Paul guitar licks. You know, that's him playing lead guitar and all the bendy bits, the bendy stuff between the verses and stuff. And I do remember him at home practicing those licks. It's a John song primarily, but Paul was playing, had these lead guitar ideas. And I remember the night before, I think, his session, working them out on this Epiphone, I guess it was, guitar.
The Beatles, they must have been very comfortable with each other, you know, because if you're someone who's shy and you're afraid to throw out an idea or a suggestion for a song, it's not, you know, you need to be able to just be comfortable with, hey, I came up with this. What do you think of this? You know, if you're keeping those things close to the vest, it's not going to work. They seem to just throw everything out there.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. And George Martin, to his credit, was very receptive and tolerant to any radical ideas.
As we get to the end of the book, some of the letters are more difficult. We already talked about Zigzag, which is a George Harrison song. I even think it might be a B-side from the Cloud
album. Yeah, I can't remember. I think so.
I was wondering what would be here for the letter V, and you have Vintage Clothes.
Don't live in the past. Don't hold on to something that's changing. What we are and what we wear is vintage clothes. Vintage clothes. Vintage clothes.
It's from Paul's solo album, Memory Almost Full, which I love that solo album so much, and I haven't heard this song for so long. I immediately listened to, as soon as I'm like, vintage clothes, what is that? I got to listen to that again.
Yeah, I had the same reaction. I mean, I when I looked under V, obviously I found the title because I've got an alphabetical list of all the songs. I didn't remember it. I had to go and listen.
As a producer, Peter, who did you look to? Who was it? A George Martin? Was that obviously that had to be an influence?
Yes, I mean, as I say, I didn't really know quite what producers did, but my only experience of watching a producer had been the records Gordon and I made, which, you know, and the producers we worked with who were EMI producers. So I just sort of picked it up as I went along. The records we all loved, of course, were all the American records. We loved Motown and we loved Stax, and we were always trying to go, how did they do that? How did they get that huge bass sound that we couldn't get and things like that? And the Beatles were the same way.
So
we didn't know much about what producers did, but we were jealous of what they succeeded in creating.
So you would just try to emulate what you like yourself, see if you could get that sound.
Yes, and you know, and you'd steal ideas too. I mean, Buddy Holly records, where Buddy Holly would make them, you know, without a normal drum kit. You know, there'd be some record where he just had a, you know, little pitter patter on a box thing going on, like Every Day or something.
Yeah.
Every day. It's a getting closer, going faster than a roller coaster. Love like yours will surely come my way. Hey, hey, hey. Every day it's a getting faster. Everyone said go ahead and ask her. Love like yours will surely come my way. Hey, hey, hey. Every day seems a little longer. Every way loves a little stronger.
And we'd go, that's so cool, let's try and do that, you know. So you'd be trying to steal ideas from everybody.
And I don't want to gloss over the amount of music that Peter and Gordon recorded. You guys have, I don't know, 10 plus studio albums. It's unbelievable.
I guess, yeah, it gets so muddled because in like everything, America and Britain would muddle up the albums.
Right.
And
yeah. There'd be American releases and British releases. And that is annoying.
But we did some all kinds of, we did a Nashville album. Yeah. That was really fun and all kinds of stuff.
All right. Before I let you go, if you had to name your top three Beatles songs, can't do it.
Not going to do it. I tell only because it's the question I get asked in emails, you know.
Oh, well, then I feel stupid that I ask it.
No, not at all. But not in the slightest. But what's your favorite this? And what's your... The two questions I get are that and then one other one you haven't asked, which is what if questions. What, you know, what if John... Do you think they'd get back together if they... You know, all that stuff. And they go... You know, just like in our own lives, those questions are utterly pointless.
Yeah. What if questions are? How about this? Would you ever do a book like this for another band? Let's say the Rolling Stones.
Gosh, I don't know. If somebody asked me, I suppose I'd think about it and see if you know. It might be interesting. Yeah, it's a good question. I'm a big Stones fan. I used to go and see them once a week in London, you know, before they ever made records.
I'm so jealous of that.
They were great. You know, I was a big Brian Jones fan as well as a Mick and Keith fan. And Bill and I are still friends. And I see Mick occasionally. But yeah, I was a big Stones fan. So that would be interesting. I remember going to see them with Paul one night at the Scene Club in London. Mm-hmm. And before that, I used to go, I went every week when they were at the, it was called Studio 51. It was Ken Collier's Jazz Club every night, and then Monday night was R&B night, and the Stones were there every week.
And that's back when they played, they weren't really writing original material so much.
Not at all, no. Jimmy Reed, Bo Diddley, Arthur Alexander, all that kind of stuff. Willie Dixon. No, they didn't write any songs at all.
Yeah, that's the thing. The Beatles' early albums had original songs mixed in with covers. The first few Rolling Stones songs were basically all blues covers.
Yes. And covers of, you know, records people didn't know, the Valentino. Right. People didn't know Arthur Alexander, you know. They didn't. So, yeah, there, a lot of people, and Time Is On My Side, nobody knew that song until the Stones. So yeah, they just had great record collections, you know.
Oh, well, Peter, I want to thank you again for doing this today. You've been delightful. And I wish you continued success in everything. I hope you're back behind the boards producing some of the artists I love soon. I love the Steve Martin, Edie Brickell record that you recorded.
Nashville. Send me an email. Tell me how you're doing, how it's treating you. Did you find a new job? Did you find a new love? Is it everything that you were dreaming of?
Yeah, they were fun to do. You know, Steve is such a brilliant writer, and you know, I'd heard it's a little story, but I'd heard these banjo tunes he'd written and loved them, and he told me that Edie Brickell had written melodies on top of some of them and some lyrics, and he played that to me over dinner one night, and I said, this stuff is great, you know, you should just there's an album in here somewhere, and. We talked about it for a while, and I was on the plane on the next day when he emailed me, do you want to produce the record? We're going to do that. Great, I'm in.
People should seek that album out. It's fantastic. Peter, where can we find you? Do you have a website? Where are you on social media? Or aren't you?
Yeah, there's a peterashermusic.com website. And then people are welcome to email me, too. It's peterasher@siriusxm.com.
How great is that? That's how I got in touch with you.
And I promise to answer every email, and I do.
Fantastic. Peter, you stay safe and healthy and well, and hopefully we'll be out of quarantine soon. And my best to you, and thank you so much for doing this.
My pleasure. Thanks a lot.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye.
All right. That's the interview with Peter Asher. I hope you guys enjoyed listening to it as much as I enjoyed doing it. Peter was gracious and just a lovely gentleman. So thanks again to Peter Asher. I also want to let you guys know that the Patreon supporters will be able to win. I got 3 copies of The Beatles from A to Z, an alphabetical mystery tour written by Peter Asher. And I want to thank Henry Holt Publishing for sending these books along to me. So I will be giving those 3 books away. If you're a Patreon supporter, you'll be able to win one of these. And if you're not a Patreon supporter, go sign up. It's $2 a month, and that allows you to be eligible for all of our giveaways. That said, you can find us at Rock Solid Show on Twitter. Go to rocksolidpodcast.com for all things about the show. Go to patreon.com/rocksolidshow to support the show through Patreon. And one of the songs I had on my list that I was going to ask Peter about, but I skipped over it because we were getting short on time, is the song Please Please Me. That's the song that started it all for the Beatles. That's a letter P song. We got double P's for Please Please. So that's going to be the playout song. So again, thanks for listening, and here we go.
Please, 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 won't you? Like I please you.